Welcome to the Global Health Podcast at Georgetown University, where we are charting new directions in health and development. Where here, in our nation's capital, we have our hands on the pulse of global health. We bring you conversations with faculty and leaders in the field. From hearing about research in global health, alumni pursuits, and student field research abroad, you'll experience it all here on the Global Health Podcast. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Georgetown Global Health Podcast. I'm your host, Charlotte, and today I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Kavanaugh, Assistant Professor in the Department of International Health here at Georgetown University. Dr. Kavanaugh works at the intersection of global health, politics, and law at Georgetown University. A political scientist by training, with a long history of work in global health policy and politics, his research and writing focuses on the political economy of health policy in low- and middle-income countries, and the political impact of human and constitutional rights on population health. He is an assistant professor of global health, visiting professor of law, and directs the Global Health Policy and Governance Initiative at the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He has done research and policy work in South Africa, Malawi, Haiti, Lesotho, India, and Thailand, and was a visiting researcher at the South African Institute for Advanced Constitutional, Public, Human Rights, and International Law in Johannesburg. Dr. Kavanaugh is a member of the UNAIDS Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee and the Council of the American Political Science Association Health Politics and Policy Section. Prior to his academic positions, he led transnational policy efforts at NGOs in the U.S. and Southern Africa, focused on HIV and tuberculosis treatment, international trade, and water rights. Dr. Kavanaugh earned a PhD in political science from the University of Pennsylvania, a certificate in health law from Penn's Law School, a master in communities and policy from Harvard University, and a Bachelor of Arts from Vassar College. Welcome, Dr. Kavanaugh, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently joined the faculty in the Department of International Health here at Georgetown. How's it going so far?
It's great. Such an interesting community, really lively discussions, great students, great colleagues. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Great. And what classes are you teaching this semester?
So this semester I'm teaching two different classes. One is on policy analysis in global health. So that's helping students understand how do you go from the start of a policy problem to identifying what kind of solutions you want to have, how to implement a set of policies that'll actually solve those, and then what the politics looks like as you're trying to do that. And so that's one class that I'm teaching. The other is on the politics of global health. And so there we're actually looking at how do political factors, and by political factors, I mean the institutions of government, how, you know, who votes, how they vote, all of those things, plus things like what's the role of courts? Do countries have presidential systems? But also, how do politics like left and right divides, right? All of those things, ethnicity, all of those things, how do those play into global politics at a global level? And so you've got organizations like the World Health Organization and the UN, along with a set of NGOs and a set of a whole bunch of other actors. You've got activists, you've got people, communities that are organized. All of that influences how outcomes in global health happen. And so that's what the other course is on.
And what is your favorite thing about teaching?
God, that's a hard one. I've been really privileged in my career to get to do a whole bunch of different things, and I'm sure we'll talk about them, but to go into a variety of different settings and get to really engage with people at different levels. I love teaching for that reason, right? That people come into class with all sorts of experiences. You've got people who have grown up in the United States, who have had a certain kind of experience and have come right through undergrad and are in my classes. You've got people who have gone out and worked in various places. You've got people from all over the world here. And so having all those people together in one place and then hearing how people think about the different issues that I'm posing is incredibly exciting, actually. I mean, it's very selfish to say, but I love teaching because it helps me actually think about things in a different way, right? I have conversations all the time with colleagues in the NGO sphere or colleagues in the academic sphere, having conversations with students who may have a very different experience before they walk in that door helps me really rethink kind of a lot of my priors. It makes me a way better thinker on global health, for sure.
And can you elaborate a little bit on why policy and politics are important for global health?
So I have a thesis, which is shared by some, right, which is that we can think about a thing called the political determinants of health, that if you actually think about how power works in the world, you can actually trace how people's health is gonna play out. So, you know, for example, right now, right, one of the things we're talking about right now is the coronavirus at the time that we're recording this. And so the coronavirus, it's broken out in China. One of the ways to think about how that's gonna flow is to say, okay, I understand how the virus works, I understand how the biology works, I can do my R-naught and I can do my epi and I can understand how that's gonna happen. That's one way to understand the flow of the virus. The other way to think about it is, what's the political system into which this virus is happening? What's the way in which we can think about that? And that's the work that I do. And so we should think about things like, well, here's a virus that's broken out in an authoritarian context. What's that going to mean? Right. And one of the things we're seeing playing out right now is that everybody is kind of, I think, running around on Twitter and at the World Health Organization trying to figure out, is China withholding information? Right. My argument is China's not withholding information. China is an authoritarian state. So how should we understand that? Well, we know that it's very good. Authoritarian states writ large are very good at some things, like controlling people. They're very good at, they can shut down an entire city and say you can't move. But what they struggle with is information flows, both to and from people, right? And so it's hard for them to get information to the population that's trusted and clear. And it's very hard for the Chinese government at the central level to get information from local officials, because all of the incentives in the political system are to tell your superiors that everything is fine, that it's under control. And so we should understand politics as the flow of power, and how power works has a huge influence on how people's health is gonna play out.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating train of thought, too. And I feel like most people don't really think of global health and law as being interconnected, but you teach courses both here on main campus and also at the law school. What exactly is global health law?
So the idea of global health law, and I'm really lucky to be here at Georgetown, where kind of the parent or the grandparent of global health law really sits, which is Larry Gostin, who's at the law school and who is the faculty director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health there at the law school. And he has really kind of pioneered a bunch of this, but it's also been led by a number of leaders in the global north and the global south who have really thought through the role of law. The idea of global health law is that we can think about law on two different levels. We can think about international law, that is the law and the rules through which states work with each other. So that's things like when you're going across a border, do you have to be screened for diseases? Who gets to go in and out of countries? And how do we think about diseases in that way? It's things also about how do aid flows happen, right? So some countries are aid providers, some countries are aid recipients, some countries are both. Those are kind of constructed by law, right? We can think about those things. We can think about the international health regulations, right? Which say, when there's an outbreak in your country, what happens? What are your obligations to the international system to alert nearby countries so that they can actually prepare? So that's one level. And then the other level of global health law is all the law that exists in a country that helps structure how people's health happens, right? And so what's so interesting about kind of the idea of global health law is that there's this interplay between the kind of international and the local, right? If you think about, for example, this outbreak of coronavirus, on the one hand, China has a set of obligations under the international health regulations where all countries have signed, and their obligations are to report report the disease. And then there's an obligation, for example, not to have travel restrictions that are undue, because that would actually harm business and it would harm, et cetera. And it actually disincentivizes countries from being honest, right? And if what we want is we want best global health outcomes for people, then we need countries to report. The law, international health law regulations say you're not allowed to impose unnecessary trade and travel restrictions. At the same time, right, so that's when we're thinking about China in the international sphere. At the same time, China is thinking about what is its obligations within its own country, right? And so what's technically a cordon sanitaire, but which is talking about a quarantine, the laws that allow China to do that actually differ country to country. That same exact kind of cordon would actually probably be illegal in the United States, would be illegal in some places. The state wouldn't have that same power. And so how do you think about the role of law? The idea at the core of global health law is that law structures people's health. It both creates an environment where people can be healthy, can get access to services, or it can harm, right? And so as we think about things like, you know, if you criminalize certain activities, right? So let's talk about the criminalization of gay sex. Let's talk about the criminalization of sex work, right? A variety of things. These are things that are not about the health system per se. They're about criminal law. And yet what happens is if you criminalize certain people, what we know is that they then don't seek health services. They then aren't able to be honest with their healthcare providers. They then, you know, do end up in a variety of places that actually make them less safe. And that, do you know what it does? It drives other diseases like HIV. And so thinking about this kind of interplay of law and health and how law structures health outcomes is the idea of global health law.
And you, every time you talk about this, you sound so excited about it. How did you first become interested in global health law?
It's a really good question. I'm one of these funny people that's had a bizarre career that involved thinking about going to law school about five times and always deciding not to do so. My first job out of college was actually working at an organization called Street Law that was actually founded at Georgetown Law School. And it was working with young people to teach them about their rights. And at the time, you know, I was really thinking about becoming a lawyer and, you know, doing law in the long term. Because when I was an undergrad, I had really kind of focused in on a number of legal issues, right? And especially this intersection of law and health and families had been a big interest of mine. And so I then worked at Street Law for a while. And it was interesting because I was working with young people and kind of doing education about legal rights and running a project in juvenile justice settings and in foster care settings. And what that actually taught me was that the law is incredibly important to understand. It's incredibly powerful. And it's actually not just for lawyers, right? And so what that really made drawn home to me was, sure, law school is one path and being a lawyer is one way you can use law, but there are so many other ways that you can use law. For example, if what you want to do is change the laws, well, then it's really important to understand the concept of it. But lawyers are less often in the, you know, in the realm of changing laws than are activists and policymakers, right? And so this kind of broader understanding of law is really exciting to me. And then, you know, I've seen over and over and over again how the law is used in really problematic ways, right? It really can harm communities. And so to me, that didn't say to me, become a lawyer and live within the system. It said to me, become someone who is literate in law and figure out how to change the system.
Can you tell me a little bit about the O'Neill Institute and what kind of work you do there?
Yeah, so the O'Neill Institute, where I direct the Global Health Policy and Politics Initiative at the O'Neill Institute. The Institute was founded, named after two amazing alums of Georgetown University who gave a really generous gift to create the Institute. It's a really exciting hub for work at the intersection of law and health. Mm-hmm. And so what's great about it is that there are a number of really amazing lawyers who work there, right? I mean, it includes people like the, people who worked in the Obama administration, right? Who were the head of the chief of staff of the Office of National Drug Policy, the National HIV Office, right? A variety of people there, as well as a number of young, aspiring, excited lawyers. There's also several of us who are not lawyers, right? Who study the law from different perspectives, who really focus on a policy lens. And it's kind of the hub for work at this intersection of health law, both domestic, right? So that's why it's got this bizarre name, the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law, which is like the worst way to say what we mean is sometimes people work on the United States and sometimes people don't, right?
Yeah.
And so, right, there's some great, really amazing, amazing young lawyer there who is running a project on hepatitis C in the United States and thinking about the legal implications. There's somebody else that's really focused on addiction law, right, in the United States. And so that's some of the work. And then there's a number of us that work on the global sphere. And so I had one initiative. There's also another initiative that works on a variety of like family health is the way that they're framing it, right? So that's everything from food to sexual reproductive health. And so thinking about all those things together is very cool. I had an initiative that's called the Global Health Policy and Politics Initiative, although actually it's technically now called the Global Health Policy and Governance Initiative. We're about to change. So here's the podcast version of breaking news, right? Because what we look at really is how do governments and sources of power flow within global health? And so how can we then put together a number of initiatives that think about both studying that and sometimes changing it, right? So I'll give you an example. We have a project called called PEPFAR Watch that we work on, right? And this was founded before I actually came to Georgetown, but that is supporting civil society to engage in the PEPFAR country operational planning process, okay, right? And so PEPFAR is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It's the this $6 billion initiative where the United States government is investing funds in trying to end the AIDS pandemic alongside other big initiatives like the Global Fund and a variety of bilateral partners. And so it's a major financing mechanism for HIV. And yet, as somebody that has not, you know, that's worked in a number of different countries and been kind of firsthand in a number of these projects, what you see over and over again is that decisions aren't made by the communities that are affected by HIV, but instead by some folks in Washington. Right. And that's just the way aid works, right? So we can, on the one hand, we can rail against that, right? We can say, oh, all decisions should be made by the most affected communities. And that's kind of what I think. Mm-hmm. But I'm also very realistic about the fact that the communities that are most affected by HIV are not the communities with the most capital, right? If we look at global inequality, I think of aid as in part a bit like reparations, right? There's like the economic system is the way it is. It has gotten the way it is, not because of kind of nature, but because of a number of political and economic factors that have made some countries incredibly wealthy. Those factors are not particularly just, I think, mm-hmm, right? And to me, aid is in part about addressing that reality, really thinking about kind of how do we think about that differently. And part of doing so, though, I think, is creating mechanisms of accountability for that aid. And so if the United States government is going to be putting $6 billion into programs, well, okay, we can recognize that some of those decisions are going to be made in Washington because that's how it works, but we can also create structures of accountability that break that what's called a democratic deficit, mm-hmm, right? So I was talking a minute ago, right, about China, right? And the challenge of doing health in a place where the recipients of the healthcare and the recipients of the messages have no democratic accountability to the people who are making the decisions. Well, that's actually very similar to what's happening in aid often, right? Where the people who are making the decisions that are life and death decisions for people, those folks in Washington are not accountable to people living with HIV in Malawi or in Zambia or in Thailand, right? They aren't just not. But that doesn't have to be that way. And so part of what we've done is to actually push the PEPFAR program, and I will give huge credit to Ambassador Deborah Birx and others who are really running the PEPFAR program, because they have been incredibly sensitive and thoughtful to this message, right? And so they've created an open space in the middle of the country operational planning process where basically every year the U.S. government teams sit down and they figure out what they're going to fund. Well, she did a radical thing at the urging of activists all over the world. She opened that up. And she said, okay, civil society gets a seat at the table. Two people from each PEPFAR country come, sit, tell us what you think, be involved in all of the conversations. And that was something that a number of us really pushed for many years. That's great. And it really provides an opening because then you can actually transparently see what the decisions are based on. Why is it that they're deciding to focus on this and not this? Why fund this organization and not this organization? Why think through the different deficits that are there with a limited amount of money? What do you respond to? So that's exciting, but it also requires knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I am the leader of a person, you know, people living with HIV network in Malawi, I might not speak United States government, right? It's a bizarre language, and it's kind of a few of us have perfected some of it, right? And so part of what we do is we support civil society leaders to engage in that process, to think through it. We help them look at the data that's coming out of PEPFAR. We help them read through the plans and say, okay, here's what, you know, here's what the U.S. government actually means when they're saying this, because that allows civil society groups to bring all of the deep knowledge that they have from communities about what's working and what's not, all of the good ideas that people actually that are the users of the frontline services can then bubble up, and then we try to help support the translation of that to the other. So that's one example of just kind of what the kinds of projects that we run and how we try to bridge this gap between between politics and global health.
That's fascinating. And so between the law school and your teaching here on main campus, what have you noticed is the biggest difference or similarity between students on both sides?
You know, it's so interesting. So I taught a class last year, which sadly I'm not teaching this year, but I taught it last year, that had both global health students and law students in it. And it made you could, because then the answer to your question was very, very clear. And to me, there's two things. One, law students take the law to be gospel, right? And so part of law school is like learning to take it as gospel and then learning to tear that down, right? And the best lawyers have figured out how to do that. Not all lawyers get there. Global health students, on the other hand, were like, why is it that we're talking about the law, right? Because what do we learn in global health often, right? We learn that, like, we learn about project management. We learn about how do you run a program. We think about kind of what are the financing mechanisms and what are the economic mechanisms, and then what are the, how do you do project management, and like what you should do is you should raise money and then you should have a good team and then you should run a project for people. And so, but where's the law in there? Well, it's all over the place, but global health students are not taught to like think about that. Meanwhile, the law students are thought, oh, only think about the law. And so it's so interesting actually to have those two together, because what we ended up with was we had discussions where the global health students were saying, okay, I've got the following problem, but like, I don't understand where the law is. And the law students are saying, well, of course, here's the law. But meanwhile, the law students are saying, oh, but that's the law. And the global health students are saying, yeah, but why does that matter? Like, you can tell me that's the law, but I can tell you that from my experience and what I've read, that it's like completely not what's happening on the implementation side. That's the law is having zero impact. You think, lawyers, that you've created a great law, you want to go to the court, you want to do a variety of things. On the ground, nobody's noticing, right? And so there's a really nice synergy actually there that's really interesting. But it is a different personality type, which is also fun.
So moving on, a few months ago, you were appointed by the executive director of UNAIDS as co-chair on a new strategic advisory group. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you explain what your role is there?
I can, yeah. So Winnie Byanyima is the new executive director of UNAIDS. And I mean, I am just incredibly excited by the potential of her leadership. So she is somebody who came out of the Ugandan freedom struggle, was a member of parliament, was the head of the Women's Caucus in the Ugandan parliament, founded the opposition party there, went on to work at UNDP, and then was the head of Oxfam International. And so it's just really exciting that she's bringing all of that to bear at UNAIDS. And the part of what's really exciting about that is that HIV really sits at the intersection not just of epidemiology, not just of science, of which there is a great deal, but also of politics and of economics and of kind of the need to move things. And so what we're doing within the Strategic Advisory Group for UNAIDS is pulling together some of the world's best thinkers on HIV, but also outside of HIV, to help support her to think about a set of initiatives that she could drive forward that would really create a different kind of strategy and a bold, interesting new set of directions. We're thinking about things like, how do we finance HIV services in a world in 2020 where donor funding has actually decreased? Some very significant increases have happened by countries themselves, but those increases are not nearly big enough to counteract even the cuts from donors, let alone be enough. Right. And so how do we think about what to do here? Well, part of it is, you know, we have to think about the kind of broad financing of HIV. And it's really easy to say, OK, good. Governments must pay more. Well, that's all fine and good, except there are genuinely major problems with governments trying to pay more. For example, if the International Monetary Fund has placed a set of restrictions on the budget of a country, well, that country can't just spend more on healthcare workers, for example. Or if the country doesn't have a tax base, well, then telling the country, please pay more from a tax base that doesn't exist is actually completely impractical. And so what's really interesting is that Winnie is thinking about some of those big things. And so we're convening a whole group of experts to try to think about that and then to help inform the strategy for UNAIDS that will go into effect in 2021.
Do you have a theory, or is it known why the donor funding has decreased recently?
You know, it's about political will and political attention. There, you know, one of the reasons why funding for HIV got anywhere near what it has gotten to is because of a real global movement that's had been people inside of government and outside of government. It's been activists, it's been you know, doctors, it's been nurses, it's been people living with HIV in communities. It's also been people inside governments who have just seen the urgency and worked together to make a number of those things move. But donor funding is fickle, and so it's very hard to keep attention on a thing. And so within HIV, for example, at this point, 2/3 of people who need HIV treatment have it. Now, you and I might say 2/3. That's great, but that is not 3/3. That is not everybody who needs it. We have a really long way to go. But often donor funding is driven by the politics at home,
right?
And so if governments are not themselves hearing about it every day, you know, those 2/3 who have gotten treatment tend to be the most visible. They tend to be the people living in cities. They tend to be the people with any sort of wealth or middle class. They tend to be the people who travel internationally. They're the ones who come to conferences. And so they have treatment. The other third are the people who live in poverty, who live in rural areas, who are marginalized in some way. And that makes it a very hard sell, and governments around the world are not paying enough attention. So some of us have to work on that.
So what would you say is the role of UNAIDS today, and has it changed over the years?
It has definitely changed. So UNAIDS is a really interesting entity. It sits at this intersection of all of the United Nations agencies and then the world response to HIV. And right, it came out of a time when the AIDS response just deeply, deeply failed. We don't have to have had a pandemic that has 37 million people living with HIV. That was not necessary. It was preventable. And frankly, the world failed on a pretty epic scale to get ahead of the pandemic. And at each stage, the pandemic just overtook the response up until a certain point. And so what has happened is that by the late 90s, there was clarity that both HIV was a massive problem for the Global South, and that the United Nations response to it was completely failing, right? It had been led by the World Health Organization. They had failed to pull the United Nations together, et cetera. The UNDP and UNICEF, et cetera, were off doing their own things. The United Nations was failing to address it. And so the world movement demanded something better from the United Nations. And that what was created was the joint program of the UN, of UNAIDS. And what it is the gathering of all of the UN agencies under one umbrella with a small secretariat on top of it that tries to mobilize all of the power of the United Nations system toward ending AIDS. And so that has actually proved far more effective. UNAIDS has been, you know, pretty effective. There's some pluses and minuses. That's a different podcast. We could have that one too someday. But it is a really interesting agency that has really brought together that, but it's also connected the UN to communities, right? And so in the AIDS world, the networks of people living with HIV, the clinicians out there are organized and powerful. And so UNAIDS has been a bridge between them and the United Nations in a way that basically no other UN agency has been able to replicate. And it's really remarkable. At the time that it was founded, the UNAIDS job was to just do that, to connect the UN and to make people care about HIV. And then more recently, the job of UNAIDS has really been to help advance the science into policy, right? How does that work? There's a kind of new set of goals that were set. There's kind of new frameworks that were given. The science into policy piece was a big piece. That's all where it is right now. We have the science. It's really good. We know what the policy answers are. They're pretty clear. But governments are not implementing them. Mm-hmm. And so the role of UNAIDS today is to figure out how to overcome that reality, right? What are the barriers? And most of them are political, economic, and social. So how do we actually overcome those barriers in the near term? Because that's what's holding the AIDS response back. We're really worried because what we're seeing in the HIV response right now is a real flatlining of progress. And that's going to continue until we can get at some of these structural issues.
And so you've done research and policy work all over the world. Is there a particular country that you really enjoyed working with?
God, I've been super lucky to get to work in a variety of different places, and that's been a real pleasure. I mean, so one of the first places outside the United States that I spent serious time was in South Africa, mm-hmm. and it's a place that I hold very, very dear. I have, wonderful friends there. It's also a place of amazing social movements. Mm-hmm. And, if you haven't gathered to this point, that's kind of my jam,
yeah.
Right? There are such fascinating politics in South Africa because it's a place where, much like the United States in certain ways, right? There's a long history of, racial injustice. Mm-hmm. You've got systems of segregation in the United States that mirror systems of apartheid in South Africa. And then you had movements that have actually overthrown those systems and are kind of trying to grapple now with the results of that. But, in South Africa, there was an end point, right? So it was like 1994, Like, that's when there were elections, the system of apartheid fell, and they've been really grappling with that. And so what's so interesting is that out of that very recent memory has come all of these fascinating political actors who are thinking about things like, how do we have a national health insurance in South Africa that actually addresses the needs of the majority of South Africans when the privatized system we have now, along with the set of kind of publicly supported services, is really failing the majority of South Africans? How do we bridge that gap? And it's all about, like, who can you get to pay for what and how? So that's so interesting. I think there's also just, like, there's a certain amount of home comfort to me in South Africa as a place that I've been a lot, but also that, like, really does have mirrors to the United States in interesting ways. So that might be my answer.
And do you have any advice for people who are working abroad in health for the first time?
So I think you've got a couple of things. One is to, like, read as much as you possibly can before you go, written by scholars, especially if you're working in the Global South, from the Global South, and really think about it. I mean, there's a, I think, a really important push right now that's kind of being labeled in various places, the kind of decolonized global health push. And that, I think, is just an incredibly important space, because what it's thinking about is, what's the role of people in doing global health, right? And so what is global health? It has a wide variety of names, et cetera. But if part of it is people doing work in countries that they were not born in, et cetera, if that's, you know, then that is a key part of it, right? How do we think as people who might engage in that about what our responsibilities are, what power we bring to that, what privileges we bring to that, and how we can actually use those in ways that are valid and effective? You know, the bottom line is there are differential, you know, access to resources in various places. But where we're going off and saying, ah, we've come to save you, then we run into real problems in global health, right? Like, we are not saviors. That's not the job of global health. I think of global health as, how do we stand in solidarity with people, and how do we bring bridges that actually allow communities to connect across? Where we say, for example, that the health and value and life of a person living in a community that has far less access to resources than the community I come from, those have equal value. And so what is my obligation there, right? But you can also get into a real savior complex there, where I've come to save you. I've come to give you knowledge that has come from the great white north. And that can be really problematic, right? And so thinking about ahead of time, okay, what can I read? Who can I think about? How can I challenge my thinking before I go anywhere? And then once I'm someplace, right, how do I think about who's really in charge? Who am I serving? How do I make sure that I am working in the service of others, not my own agenda? And then I'm assuming that actually people have vastly more knowledge often than I do. And so what do I have to contribute?
Yeah, no, I think that's really important, especially in our global health program. We do go abroad and we do research, and I think it's important for people to keep in mind, because you might subconsciously start thinking with that white savior complex, and that is, it can be dangerous. And my last question for you is, what's something that you've read or watched recently that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Oh, gosh. You know, there are so many good things that I have read and watched lately. You know, okay, so I'm going to have a couple. One is, so Madhu Pai out of the University of, I'm going to get this wrong, I think he's at McGill, has written a whole series of articles recently on thinking about decolonizing global health. And I would totally encourage people to go check that out. I think it's a really interesting, and they're all, like, it's on, you know, Forbes.com and, you know, some of those places that are just worth their very thoughtful kind of think pieces. Also, his Twitter feed is remarkably useful. So I'm a fan. I'm going to get him actually to come virtually into our class that you don't know about yet. But that's going to be probably the last class of a class that you're in. And so that is going to be really interesting. I think that's one thing that's really worth checking out. I think, you know, beyond that, there, you know, there's a number of different interesting books that have come out recently in the politics of global health, right? And so, you know, Sarah Davies and a couple other people have written some really interesting books recently. There's three or four that have come out that are really about kind of how do countries do global health politics. And what's interesting is, I think that is increasingly resulting in there being a field of global health politics that you can actually go and read. And then the final thing I will just put in a plug for that I just read is a book that I'm going to get. It's called Regimes of Inequality by Julia Lynch. And what she does in that book is she explains how how is it that inequality has resulted in differences in health outcomes in rich countries, right? So she's focused on Europe. She's interested in kind of European, European health politics. But what she does that's so smart is she says, okay, there is a question about how health outcomes are formed. But let's not assume that the answer to how health outcomes are formed is through healthcare, right? What if we look at countries and we say, oh, wow, countries with universal healthcare systems and countries without still have massive differences in health equity. And so if that's true, right, then we need to look beyond healthcare. We need to think about a wide variety of things. And actually, what she argues is when we spend too much time arguing about health per se, instead of arguing about inequality per se, we lose the point, right? So I think she would argue, and you know, I don't know if I agree with her, but it's an interesting argument, right? That all the global health students should stop spending way too much time worrying about health and instead frame everything about inequality, because if you improve inequality, then you will improve health equity. It's an interesting argument and one that's worth thinking about.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, so glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Global Health Podcast, brought to you by the Department of International Health here at Georgetown University. We welcome you to learn more by visiting our website at globalhealthms.georgetown.edu or by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.